Welcome back to Nothing Scarier Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Kayla.
And I'm Courtney.
And it is warm. I don't know.
Finally.
Fucking transitions are hard. So it's warm-ish. It hit like 80-something degrees yesterday.
We were downtown last night and it wasn't cold at night. And I was like, so it's summer. We went from not summer to summer.
Yes, very quickly. There's probably going to be freeze at some point, right? Like, we're not quite past Michigan, you're screwed zone, but
yeah. I hope not. We had like a freeze warning on Friday night, and then it was like warm last night. So,
yeah, I brought my strawberries in. They lived in the shower for a couple days.
I can't hear anything. So, I went to a metal show last night. I'm a little too old for that. So, but I can hear, but kind of.
So. You said it sounds like you got a pillow wrapped around your head, right?
Yeah.
I'm going to a show next week, but the person that invited me to the show, I was like, listen, I really want to go to this show, but I don't think I could do pits anymore as much as I really like them. And she was like, I know, I got seats, we're old, it's fine.
I still like to tell myself I can do pits.
Yeah. I like to watch from on high and be like, yeah, I could do that, full well knowing it would be the hospital. So it's exciting times. I hope your hearing comes back soon.
I was just right next to the speakers.
Best place to be if you want to feel the music.
Yeah.
All right.
Not
well,
much else afterwards. Oh, sorry.
Oh, you're good. You're good. I just wanted to, right off the top here, we talked a little bit about it, you and I off mic before we began. Just a little announcement that we are going to be moving the cast to an every other week cadence. A couple reasons for it, but one of the main reasons is that I personally never don't really want to subscribe to hustle culture as much as I overwork myself. And I think it's super important for folks to kind of know that a lot of work does go into creative content and putting that out. And I actually really enjoy what we're doing here. And I want to make sure that I continue enjoying what I'm doing and it doesn't feel like a 9-to-5. So with that in mind, also, I've been reading this really good book. It's called Laziness Does Not Exist. I recommend it. 10 out of 10 gold stars. We're going to be moving to an every other week cadence after this. So this one comes out on the 30th of April. Mm-hmm. And then the 7th, we won't have one, but we are still around on the socials. In the following Tuesday, which if I do math in dates, is the 14th. That'll be the following one. So you'll still get a Courtney episode. You'll still get a Kayla episode. We are still around on the socials. We're just going to make sure that we are taking some time to rest, which is where creativity comes from. And yeah, making sure that we're putting out content that we're excited about, but also not overworking ourselves into the ground. And I think that our listeners especially, like, I think y'all get it. Right? Like, we have literally the nicest folks that message us and talk to us. So, yeah, there we are.
Thanks, guys.
Doors obviously open for us to come back to every week episodes in the future. I don't know if this will just be like a summer thing or like a let's get some rest behind us now that it's warm out kind of thing. But yeah, that'll be what it is for at least a little bit.
Yeah.
All right.
Life is like that sometimes.
Yeah, and it's good. It's very good to rest, honestly. Yeah. Or like, you know, just because you can run X number of miles. I can't run a mile. But just because I could, doesn't mean I should every day, all day. So there it is. I'm going to take a sip of my water. It made an exceptionally cool noise before we started recording. I'm a little excited to see if it does it again. It probably won't.
It did.
Hey! I really hope that makes it in. I don't know why this cup makes that cool noise, but homie, it does.
It's a musical instrument.
All right. I can see that. I'm down for that. I don't know how to transition into our show. That's water. Our buried person did not have water. They only had booze. That's a transition.
enough. I was gonna try to do like a segue at one point involving like I can't hear. It's like I'm buried underground, and I immediately forgot it.
Quality though, like 10. You could. You want to float that? You want to just try and see.
Yeah, I can't really hear. It's like almost like I'm buried underground, like Ryan Reynolds in this movie.
Yeah, that's right, y'all. We watched the 2010 movie Buried. I gotta say, I was out in the first and came around to it in the second, and then was almost fully out again in the third. This was a little bit of a did I like this? I don't know, but I got some information for you.
It's a movie.
Gosh. So Buried, made in 2010, is a Spanish survival thriller film directed by Rodrigo Cortez and was written by Chris Sparling. It focuses on the ordeal of Paul Conroy, a contractor in Iraq who was kidnapped and wakes up in a pine coffin buried alive. Dun, dun, dun. Movie has very few stars. We only see Ryan Reynolds, really, as the only person that we see throughout the entire movie is Ryan Reynolds as Paul. We also have Jose Luis Garcia Perez as Jabir, who's a voice on the phone. We also have Robert Patterson, who I meant to look up. Is that an author? Is he the author? Is he the author? I meant to look it up and I didn't. You guys can tell me. But he voices Dan Brenner, the like hostage negotiator guy in the movie. The film debuted at the Sundance Film Festival on January 23rd of 2010. After its debut, it had some really good reception. So this kicked off kind of a bidding war for distribution rights between Lionsgate and Screen Gems, TriStar Pictures, and Fox Searchlight all wanted the movie. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, Lionsgate won the rights for distribution in the United States and the UK. Apparently, it was like a big old bidding war, which,
yeah,
like there was okay. A lot on it. And I was like, okay, this was a lot. Cool, guys. I'm glad you won. The movie had a limited theatrical debut in the United States on September 24th. We see that a lot with movies of this type, where they like kind of debut it to a smaller audience, and then they do a tiny little release so people are talking about it, and then they do a wider release a couple weeks later. So full release on October 8th of the same year. Its initial trailer was unveiled alongside A Nightmare on Elm Street in 2010, which might be where I saw the trailer for this movie, is after watching the 2010 Nightmare on Elm Street.
I was like, wait, what? I immediately was thinking of like the original one, and I was like, hold on.
They went back in time. I saw your face. I was like, the 2010.
The 2010.
Yeah. And I there was another debut, like a different trailer that was debuted at the 2010, which is hard to say, San Diego Comic-Con International. So a little bit of like, I don't know, breadcrumbing, putting stuff in there throughout the year. I remember seeing the trailer. I forget which movie. It might have been Dinner for Schmucks, maybe? I don't know. I remember seeing the trailer, and it was, I talk about a little bit during the movie what the trailer was. So there's a couple of them floating out there that made it seem different from what it might have been. Or maybe it actually, I take that back. I think maybe the trailers made it seem exactly like what it was, but I was anticipating something different. Maybe that's what it was.
I think a lot of people saw Ryan Reynolds and they were like, he's not going to be in this coffin the whole time.
Yeah.
Or like maybe there'd be like scenes like with joke, like people trying like, to find him.
Yeah. No.
No.
So it currently has a 7 out of 10 on IMDb, a 3.3 on Letterboxd, and Roy Ebert gave it a 3.5 out of 4 in his review. He was on board for it. Saying Ryan Reynolds had limited space to work in and body language more or less preordained by the coffin, but he makes the character convincing if necessarily limited. Runtime 94 minutes feels about right, and the use of 2.35 widescreen paradoxically increases the effect of claustrophobia. And he ends his entire review by saying, "I would not like to be buried alive."
I don't think anybody would.
Me either.
Homie.
Agree strongly. So vast majority of reception for the movie is positive. I mean, a couple people, like I have a very specific ick that happened in the beginning of this movie that I'm going to talk about when we review the movie itself. But for the most part, folks didn't like the fact that he was in a box the whole time. And some people critiqued his acting with like the phone scenes. But really, I mean, when your shots are semi-limited, like there's not really a whole, you can't be like, the special effects were shitty. Like, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
He's in a box, right? Like, so more or less, folks really enjoyed it. It did get nominated for a good number of awards. I think it was Goya and Gaudi, I think is how you pronounce it. GAUDI awards. Lots in all the categories for those two awards. And the most critical review seems to come again from what Ebert said. Limited ability to act. Limited, like, ability as in physical ability to embody the scenes. Seems to be, again, the top critical review of the movie.
This is how I know I have trash taste. Because I was like, did not like this movie. And everybody else is like, it's a good film. Well, I just have bad taste in things.
I don't, I mean, if it's not your cup of tea, it's not your cup of tea, right?
Yeah. Like,
I just, my specific yuck is, I'll get into it. But like, I mean, for the fact that this person was in a box the entire movie, I feel like there was some shoehorned action in there too. And I'll talk about that as well. But like, it was fun. It was like a movie. Like, it was a movie.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna pay to watch it. Yeah. But I wouldn't be like, oh my God, I never want to watch this movie again. You know, like, it's fine. It's fine. Ready for fun facts?
Yes. I love fun facts.
So the movie was shot in just over 16 days. So most people quote 16 days or 17 days, just over 16.5. And they used seven different coffin builds to film the entire movie. Most frequently utilized coffin variant, because they named their variants, was nicknamed the Joker, and it was prized for its adaptability and being kind of a wild card when filming in it. It had removable walls, which allowed for shooting from one angle at a time, and also allowed for the right kind of sound while shooting. So when they were filming, they'd remove one piece of the coffin, or like one wall of the coffin, but keep all others so that the sound bouncing and everything like that stayed, you know, correct as much as could be. Another iteration of the coffins was named the Tunnel, and it was basically just a long shot that was tailored for like perspective effects so that you could see like full body in some scenes. And there's also another one named the Wall, which featured extra tall walls on each side, so that when they filmed from top down, they could do so by capturing the whole thing. So that it's not like, you know, when you have to crop something to put it on Insta and you're like, motherfuck, I need the outside. Like, that's what that is.
Okay.
Well, it took just like 16 or 17 days to film. It was long enough for Ryan Reynolds to develop some injuries and some kind of serious short-term anxieties around small spaces and specifically sand. So while he was filming, he was just constantly banging his head on the box, physically moving inside of the box. He kept having to hold that Zippo, which he reported was hot as fuck. And he's like, I don't know how I have fingers after this. That was hot. Scratching himself up on the wood. He actually walked away with a bald patch, lots of bruising, and lots of scratches at the end of the little bit over 2 weeks filming. It was filmed chronologically. So by the time that the sand started to fill the coffin, Ryan was admitted that he was suffering from some kind of serious claustrophobia. He'd already really hurt his back by staying in the box for that long. And they just constantly had to make sure that there was a paramedic team on standby because he was not having a good time, but also not quitting.
Oh, buddy.
He said that he passed out a number of times filming, saying that the thing I wasn't ready for or realized when I was shooting is that when you're out of breath and you're not moving to accommodate to the oxygen in your blood, your body passes out. So he was like hyperventilating, and then he couldn't like stand up or move or like put his body in a comfortable position. So he just like pass out for a hot minute.
Wow.
He was describing like they just would be like mid scene. He'd pass out. He'd come back. They give him a minute, and then they just keep fucking going.
Ryan Reynolds is a professional, man. Jesus Christ. Oh, he's up. Oh, he's down.
Don't give him a minute. He'll come back. Time him. Like, jiminy crickets. So in order to combat, like, because the passing out obviously wasn't convenient, which, like, yeah, it's your body telling you something to do, but, like, I get it. He just kind of tucked, like a brown paper bag to, like, help him calm his breathing enough to not hyperventilate in those scenes, because he was just, because it was chronological, he was fully, like, getting more and more fucked up and more anxious and more tired of, like, being trapped in a fucking box while he was filming. So by the end of it, like, I think I have this in here somewhere, the claustrophobia and, like, the panic, and then, like, the release of, I finally get to get out of this fucking box that you see on his face, because the character dies, but Ryan Reynolds obviously lives.
Yeah.
That's all real. Like, that's, I mean, as much as acting is real, right? Like, he was fully feeling those things as a human being and then also acting those things.
That's trauma. Just
fucking, yeah,
oh,
man.
No. Oh, wow.
So in an interview in October of 2010, Ryan spoke about what it was like to try and unwind after filming this movie. And he said, all of the physical injuries are like souvenirs, but the emotional stuff is harder. When you're spending 17 days straight in a heightened state of anxiety and panic, it is not very good for your nervous system, so you walk away pretty jittery. I definitely struggled a lot with insomnia when I was working on this film, and that was something completely new to me. And then he went on to say about how he actually unwinds. There's not a lot of ways to unwind properly from a film like this. I never take traditional vacations. Usually I try and make my vacations into The Amazing Race. So I had planned your standard kind of lay down on a beach somewhere and try not to do anything, but, you know, maybe read a book. But that didn't work out so well, because what I didn't think of in advance is that I would be actually laying on sand. So I did actually go to the place I was supposed to be vacationing at and stayed for like 6 hours and then just went home.
Oh, poor buddy. Oh,
that's fucked. Oh, this is nervous laughter. This isn't like you loser laughter. This is like, oh my God, buds. Yeah, like,
well, you fucked yourself up for this movie.
Maybe we should have spent a week like hypertherapy or some shit, because that's fucking rough. He's like, I booked this beautiful vacation on a beach where I was just going to do nothing and just try and relax my nervous system, but instead I touched sand and freaked the fuck out. Like,
yeah, no, that's like, you really fucked yourself up for that movie, dude. Yeah. Wow.
I mean, this is 2010, you know, 2010. So I hope it has since gotten better, because holy fuck. Yeah, that's just fucking rough.
Yeah, I don't think anybody like did the math on like, well, he won't really be like in the box. The wall will be out, or this will be out, or whatever. And then he's down for like 2 weeks, and they're like, oh, it's really fucking with him. We should probably wrap this up. Oh, shit.
Yeah. Yep. And there was a lot of comparison between this director's work on this film in particular and like how he pulls like inspiration from Hitchcock. And I wish,
gross,
pulling inspiration from Hitchcock did not mean actually traumatizing your actors. Like,
yeah,
there should be something there. And there's a couple other stories, like a couple other trivia pieces about Ryan having like an actual like panic attack during filming and like needing to actually get out of the box for a minute and calm down. I didn't see him speaking to any of that like fully, so, you know, take that with a grain of salt, not sand. And sorry, my brain went, say, take it with a grain of sand, but that's fucky. So either way, like this, his panic, all of that to say, his panic and then his relief that you see in that character's face. Obviously, he's acting, he's a professional, he's an actor. But there is a level of, ooh, like, how much did we need to dig for this in that moment? Because, yeah, especially that scene towards the end where he kind of like, he just gives up into it, right? Like that, I was like, ooh, okay, that's real. Like, that's rough. All right.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
So mad respect, Ryan. I feel bad now being like, what is this movie?
I mean, you don't have to like it. And he could have stopped, right? Like, there's that. Like, he took the movie. He did talk about how he was excited to take the movie and that he, like, did enjoy the final product. But yeah, booking a beautiful vacation somewhere and then realizing you can no longer touch sand.
The minute you get the sand, you're like, fuck.
Yeah, oops, oops. Like, yeah, that's rough.
Grass for me from now on.
Grass for me. All right. Are you ready to talk about the movie?
Yes.
Okay. So because today's entire movie takes place inside of a coffin, I'm going to revert to more of like our original synopsis style and less of like a shot by shot. I got a little bit of my like notes in here, but my notes started to say still in a box, still in a box. And I was like, obviously we know we're in a fucking box. So I also wanted to note at the top that I fully noped out of this movie for like a couple days because I really, really can't stand the propaganda angle that we've got in the beginning of this movie.
Yeah.
We could have gone for literally any other reason that somebody was in a box. And Paul frequently goes out of his way to be like, not me. I'm not in military. I'm just a contractor. And it's implied that he was a contractor hired by the military. And I'm going to try not to get like on my soapbox too fucking much about it. But I do want to call it out at the beginning that this is a very of the times and it doesn't make it right.
Yeah.
Kind of situation. And there is a little bit of a conversation that happens a little later in the movie, and I'm going to get back on my soapbox for that. But for now, I do want to call it out at the top that this felt very propaganda. And I noped out for a couple days and then came back and finished the movie. So I was like, fuck you in the box you're stuck in. Like, I just...
Yeah. Honestly, I feel like if we could have found something else, we might have. But...
Yeah.
It is what it is.
I do think that I need to get a little, like, smaller than a shoebox, but visible box, like, soapbox to put on my desk for when I need to, like, vent about shit. Because I go, like, tangents. I need a soapbox.
Yeah, I do that. We both do that.
And then I'll just put it away for when I need to shut the fuck up. Like, just physical reminder of shut the fuck up. All right. So our movie opens when Paul Conroy, an American civilian working in Iraq, awakens to find himself trapped in a wooden coffin. He has a Zippo lighter, a pen, a BlackBerry, what up, 2010, within reach. And after panicking way less than I would have panicked, he starts to try and figure out how he got into the fucking box and how to get out of the fucking box. His first attempt for help is to call 911. And he's in Iraq. And he calls 911 and he ends up talking to a dispatcher in Youngstown, Ohio. And the dispatch woman is like, sir, this is a Wendy's. Like, what do you want me to do? Like, this is what?
I can't help you.
Where are you? Do you want me to transfer you? Yeah. So then he calls the FBI in Chicago after telling the directory person he literally does not care which FBI location she connects him to. Which was like a red flag for me. Like, is this a crank call? I don't know. He's like, I literally don't care. And she's like, sir, calm down. I just need you to pick one.
Yeah, right. Because like, you don't Chicago. Expect like a crazy phone call like that. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, hey, I know you're in a box, but you gotta like
shut the fuck up.
You gotta like talk this. You gotta talk to the people to get help. Because this is like, he ends up calling like six people.
Mm-hmm. So then he calls his employer, who's just like, I need you to call the safety number. And he's like, fucking listen to me. They took it. I don't have a safety number. What are you fucking talking about? All of these calls are to no avail. Eventually, he does, in the box, receive a call from his kidnapper, and this is Jabir, demanding $5 million in ransom under threat of being left to die in the coffin. Alongside, like, all of the other things that were in the coffin, he does have a script provided by his captor. Paul discovers a malfunctioning flashlight, a glow stick, a flask containing alcohol, and a pocket knife in the box with him. Paul then decides to try and contact the State Department, learning that they are going to adhere to a policy of not negotiating with terrorists and thus will not pay the ransom.
Thanks, bro. America.
However, they assure him that the rescue efforts and connect him to Dan Brenner, the head of the hostage working group. So this is our other like main voice in the movie. And there's a convo between Paul and Dan where Paul starts talking about like, what do you mean be fucking calm? What do you mean you're not going to pay? Like, how do I know you're even going to fucking help me? Like, fuck you. Da, 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 da. Like, my friends all died. We weren't even this. We weren't even that. And it's a little bit later in the movie, right? Like, Paul's been in the box for a hot minute. It's honestly almost halfway through that he starts to have this conversation with Dan.
Mm-hmm.
About halfway through, we do get a line where Dan goes out of his way to say the people that did this are just people, not terrorists. that they're just trying to take care of their families, which soapbox is away, but just for a second. It's like, this is a good point to make, but it's so far into the movie at this point, and the way that it's delivered makes it exceptionally, in my opinion, easy for anybody prone to buying into propaganda to be like, but what about Paul? It doesn't matter that they're normal people, and kind of disassociate from like the fact that what he's saying is probably true. It's just people trying to make some cash, right? Like what they're doing is not right.
No.
But the it still sticks to me as propaganda, because at this point you're trying to root for the person in the box to get out. You're not coming into the situation with like full terms of the situation. But box is away. It's away. So they do say, they do address it-ish in the movie. Anyway, I put a note here that I think it is exceptionally hard to do prolonged talking on the phone acting.
Mm-hmm.
That's all the note says. It's difficult to do that. I get it. It's fine. But it's hard.
Yeah.
During this conversation, Brenner advises Paul to conserve the battery of his BlackBerry and strongly urges him against fulfilling the demand for a hostage video that was placed on him. Do a hostage video, get me my money from kidnappers. Dan also shares the encouraging news that a man named Mark White was successfully rescued from a similar ordeal just 3 weeks prior and has since been returned home safely, which this conversation happens because Paul is like, you know what, Dan, kind of fuck you, because I don't know. You don't really even care. Like, I'm in a fucking box. No. Why would you fucking care? You're saying that you've done this before. What are their names then? If you actually cared about them, you'd remember their names. And Dan's just like, Mark White, he's a 26-year-old college student that was here helping with, you know, Doctors Without Borders or some jazz. And he's home studying again. And he's doing great. Yeah, he's great. And this kind of calms Paul down. But Dan.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Paul also says, you know, if this happened before, like, how many people have you actually saved? And Dan just says, not many.
cool.
Not many. But not many. So Paul receives a direction to preserve his battery life on his phone. He's told, put the ringer on because it uses less battery than a vibrate function, and don't call a bunch of people, and don't make that video. Whatever you do, don't actually make the video. And they also talk about, Paul says, well, I've got anxiety, and this is obviously making it worse. And Dan is like, well, do you have your meds on you? Which, like, props, I guess. They left his meds on him.
Yeah, that's a random thing to do.
Yeah, it seems a little ex-machina, or whatever. It's fine. Yeah. He's got his meds.
Just take your anxiety.
So, Dan's like, just take your pills, man. It'll be fine. So he hangs up with Dan and takes a couple of his anxiety pills, and then kidnapper calls him. Flip that. He hangs up with Dan, takes a few deep breaths right when the kidnapper calls him. And kidnapper demands he makes a video again, and this sends Paul into a huge panic. So then Paul takes a couple of his pills to try and calm down.
Mm.
And, like, kind of trying to find some way to calm down and be, like, chill, he ends up trying to call his mom, who resides in a nursing home. But we get, like, this really sad back and forth of she doesn't really remember who he is. And he's just like, I think this might be the last time I talk to you. I just want to call and talk to you. So sad. Yeah, she's just like, okay, we're going to go play Rummy or whatever that it was. Like,
yeah. Jesus.
Kidnapper once again contacts Paul, demanding the video, and then sends him a very distressing image of his colleague, Pamela, with a gun to her head. Paul decides to record the video as instructed after receiving this image. This is my side note. I remember seeing the video that he records as the trailer for this movie. Do you remember the same?
No, I just remember Ryan Reynolds in a box. I don't remember that. I just remember, like, that glow from his phone and him being, like, stressed out.
I did not look up the trailer because I wanted to see if he had the same experience or if I was misremembering the experience. But I remember, like, the trailer for it was him saying what his name is, that he's been buried, like, him reading the script, like, right up on his phone. That's where I remember the trailer being. So I digress. Paul falls asleep after making the video and sending it to the kidnappers. He's taken some pills at this point, so he kind of passes out in the box. And he wakes up to a huge-ass snake in the coffin with him up his pant leg.
Yeah. They had to put, like, an action scene in the movie somewhere, I guess.
Yeah, and this is what I thought was shoehorned action scene, to be honest. Like,
They had to have snake something. They were like, we gotta break it up a little bit. Right? Like, what kind of snake is it? Is it poisonous? Is he just scared of the snake?
Yeah. Is the snake just like, are you dead? Can I eat you? Oh, you're not. My bad, Holmes. Let me get out of here. Hold on. I just gotta get to that hole. Like,
honestly, that snake in that box is the least of my worries at this point. Like, cool, bite me, I guess. I don't know.
Right?
I don't think I'm getting out of here. Nobody's really that concerned with me. Most of them are concerned about optics right now.
Yeah. Do you want to be buried alive? Or actually, I don't know. Being bit by a venomous snake is probably not a good time. Being bit by a venomous snake while you're trapped in a box underground is probably worse. Maybe he did the right thing. But either way, he decides to repel this snake by basically lighting his tiny box on fire.
Yeah, and you know what? The first thing he says is like, I don't have that much air. And he loves fire.
Yeah, he keeps with the fucking Zippo.
Stop it. Just sit in the dark. Stop.
Or like, you have a whole glow stick. Mm-hmm. I know he didn't find the glow stick till after he found the Zippo, but he lit up that Zippo after being told to conserve oxygen. I was like, stop.
You know how this works because you say you know how the fire works.
Right.
Stop it.
So he attempts to set the snake on fire, sets his box on fire. Snake escapes through a hole in the side of the coffin.
Just kick the snake with your boot or something. You know what I mean?
They just kick him a couple times. If you have to, like, don't set him on fire.
Yeah.
But Snake ran away. And Paul definitely burned up a lot of his air in his box doing this. After the fire scene, Paul thinks he hears voices outside of his coffin. And this prompts him to change the language setting on the BlackBerry from Arabic to English. So he's like, oh, voices speaking a different language. What language do I know? English.
Yeah, because they find the phone number. And he's like, I can't figure that out. I can't read this or whatever. And then immediately goes, oh, yeah, you can do that.
You can change the language
settings on your phone.
Yeah. So Paul discovers the device phone number, which he ends up leaving in a voicemail for his wife, trying to be like, da, 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 da. And there's an exchange with him and his wife earlier in him being trapped in the box when he's like calling a bunch of people to try and like figure out his life, where he's just like, he's like, I need you to give me the fucking number, da, 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 da. Like going off on his wife, and his wife's like, fuck you, and like hangs up on him.
That wasn't his wife, I don't think.
That wasn't his wife?
No, because his wife's name's Linda, and he only talks to her like at the end of the movie. He keeps calling her and her phone's not there. That must have been like his, like one of her friends or like his sister-in-law or like an ex or something, because they don't fucking like each other, because he's yelling at her and she's like, don't fucking talk to me like that. And he's like, and then he calms down and calls her back. He's like, can you please give me this number? Like, it's very serious. And she gives it to him. And then he goes, fuck you, and hangs up.
Yeah. I thought that was an exchange with him and his wife. Like, that's what I thought was going on. And then they were like,
then
he leaves that voicemail where he's clearly like about to fucking die. And then I thought that it was like a, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry kind of situation. Okay. Makes it a little bit better that it's not his.
No, he would never be like, fuck you.
Fuck you, and hangs up. So anyways, he's changed the language setting in his BlackBerry, figures out the phone number, which he leaves in a voicemail for his wife. Unfortunately, the video that he took about his capture does not stop the execution of Pamela, his coworker. The kidnappers subsequently sent him a video of them killing her, which was very abrupt. She's talking about who she is and what she did, and they just cap her. Cap her? Is that the word?
Yeah.
Okay.
Like, yeah. Capper is correct, yes. And
I was born in the 1900s, forgive.
Like, I don't think that's like necessary for them to have done that.
And I agree.
Like, they do that like little throwaway line about them just being people or whatever, but then make them like monsters.
Yes.
And it's like, okay.
Yeah, it's feeding that this is propaganda.
Yeah.
It feels very propaganda-y. I mean, it is a Spanish film in English language, you know what I mean? But it still feels like the tonality is. Yeah. So that video of Pamela's execution was actually pretty abrupt and jarring, and it's like unnecessary in my opinion, but it happens. This obviously upsets Paul, who has like another full panic attack, voices and thinking, and just kind of gets overwhelmed. He reaches out to Dan and is basically like, you're just a fucking babysitter. You're just here to listen to me die in this box. Fuck you. What are you even fucking doing? Da, 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 da. And Dan expresses his disappointment over the fact that Paul made the video.
Yeah, that's what he immediately is like. Why would you do that? Fuck you.
What do you mean? I need to get out of this fucking box.
I'm trying to get out of this box.
So Dan's point is that by Paul making the video, the kidnappers have no choice now but to go through with their plan because it's on the media. And I would argue that they were going to go through it anyways, but you're just upset about the optics now that you could have done something. But
yeah, if that really was it, why wouldn't you have just told him that? Like, look, if you make this video, you're going to force them into a corner. But you didn't say that. You just didn't want it to get out.
Yep.
Because you don't want, like, the public to know, like, how bad shit can be over that, like, during that situation.
Yeah, we're all just trying to hide it, and you made it impossible to hide.
Yeah.
So.
Because, you know, well, I'm not going to do the soapbox thing either. I just I started to be like,
I feel you. Yep, so Paul is freaking out at Dan. Dan's like, but we're really close. Like, we're almost there. Da-da-da. It's going to be fine. It's going to be fine. And then while on the phone with Dan, bombs drop. And Paul's coffin starts to crack and fill with sand. Like, fuck.
Yeah, it couldn't have been buried that deeply. That deep, like, yeah. With him hearing, like, voices and stuff.
Mm-hmm. But deep enough that he couldn't, it seems like deep enough that he couldn't quite get out and that he's going to be crushed by the amount of sand that he's under. While the sand is falling, Paul hangs up with Dan, or loses the connection with Dan, and his work calls.
Oh my God, dude.
In the most infuriating phone call of this entire movie, they tell him, stay calm. Who have you talked to? Hey, Paul, like, this is a bad situation. We talked to the people at the State Department. Like, this seems really bad. Who have you talked to? Yeah, you should stop talking to people. Like, keep it to that number or less, right? Like, stop telling people about what's going on, Paul, okay? By the way, I'm going to start recording. Are you cool with that? No, I need you to say if you're cool with that. No, I need you to say yes or no. States the date. It's October 23rd, 2006. Mr. Conroy, are you aware that I'm recording this conversation? And then he fires him. He just goes through and says that CRT retroactively fires you because you were fraternizing with Pam or Pamela, who was the person that was just murdered in that video. And they're doing this and they do it retroactively so that they are not going to have to pay out for his life insurance or take any responsibility on paper or in the press about their employee being murdered.
Yeah.
They're basically well, because this happened, you are still alive at the end of your contract with us. So why would we pay your life insurance?
Fucking insane, dude. And like, he gets kidnapped on a job.
Yeah.
But they said that they retroactively make his firing like before that convoy, I assume, that he's on started. Mm-hmm. So they were just going to wait for him to be done with that and then fire him. But they like, it's just to cover their ass.
Yeah.
And at first I was like, no way. And then I was like, no, that would happen.
Yeah. Optics. They're like, okay, well, he's not getting out of the box and he made that video. So now we need to make sure. What we want this to look like is this employee was no longer employed and then on his own terms was kidnapped and murdered.
And then we're going to say
he's not an employee of us.
Then we're going to lie and say he was cheating on his wife with another coworker of ours that got killed. And then his wife's going to have to like hear that.
Yep.
And it was just like, I was like, holy shit.
Yeah.
What the fuck?
Yeah. So yeah, the line was you were alive up to the point of termination. Bye.
Like, yeah. I was like, you're a piece of shit. And the guy was just like, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I am. I'm going to end the recording now. You're a piece of shit. Okay, bye. So he hangs up with his former employer and ends up on the phone again with Dan, who contacts Paul with some distressing news. The explosions that damaged the coffin were actually F-16 bombings, potentially resulting in the death of his captors, which means possibly nobody knows where he is now. And at this point, we see Paul just like fully, he's starting to shut down, right? Like he's got that little bit of dead eye kind of situation going on. He's in a box. The sand is coming in. He's like not even trying to get the sand out of his mouth anymore. Like he's just being like, he's just slowly dying. And he does ask Dan, like, do they care? Dan just doesn't really answer. And then Paul just says, it's weird knowing. Like, it's weird knowing that I'm going to die. Like, it's just weird. Mm-hmm. Yep. It was at this point in the movie that I was like, okay, maybe this isn't complete trash. Like, that, his delivery of those lines and in that conversation of, like, that the hope is lost situation, I was like, ooh, okay. Like, that had some feelings to it. That's pretty good. As hope dwindles, Paul records his final will and testament in video format. He gives his personal savings, obviously, to his wife and his clothing to his son, and has, like, these moments where he's talking about his son growing up into his clothes. It's going to take him a while to get there, and it's another character-building moment for Paul. In a desperate turn of events, which feels like the need for, we're going to give a little bit more action, but we didn't really need this part, kidnappers call again and demand that Paul, like, pay them or prove that he is going to pay them. And they demand that he cuts off a finger to, like, show that he's still going to pay. Like, I don't really understand. It was just like, let me cause you more pain for no reason.
Bombed. And, like, maybe they lost some people. So they were like, eye for an eye. At this point, they're just like monsters. So
yeah, they're just telling him that he needs to show blood or his family will show blood, and they fire off an address. And Paul's like, that's, how do you, you don't even know Michigan. And then he's like, the kidnapper's like, Detroit, Ann Arbor. And I'm like, you're just saying fucking names. Cause apparently Paul is from Hastings. What up, Michigander? Hey, not far. What up? So he's just fear mongering basically. And Paul's like, you know what? Fuck it. And just
does it.
Chops off a finger while sand falls on him. Like, he records it, chops his finger off, sends it. As he's bleeding in a box, being buried alive in sand, Paul briefly hallucinates being rescued. It's a hallucination while the phone buzzes next to him, and you get this shot of him, like, fully, like, I'm dead, with sand falling on him, and the phone just keeps buzzing next to his head. I liked that shot. It was pretty, like, powerful, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
He answers the phone and comes out of his hallucination, and Dan says, you're going to be there in, like, 3 minutes. You just have to hold on. And at this point, like, sand is getting under Paul. He's being, like, slowly smushed towards the top of the coffin. Like, he's being crushed. Then his phone's ringing, and he sees that it's his wife. So Paul hangs up on Dan and answers his phone. They exchange tears. Paul says, yeah, I'm coming home. You're right. I shouldn't have gone. I'm coming home. You got to promise. You got to swear. And his wife's like, I'm so sorry. I didn't have my phone. Got all the voicemails. Yada, yada, yada. And there's just this, like, super brief situation. And Paul actually has to hang up on her, where she's like, no. I want to wait. Da, da, da. And he's like, I got to go. They're here. And hangs up on her because he thinks that they're there, and calls Dan back. Dan says, they're digging. We're here. We're going to be there. And at one point, Paul goes, I don't hear anything. But Dan's just not listening. He's like, we're almost there. Hold on. It's like this really tense. And you can see Paul go, oh, okay. I'm dead. You guys aren't here. And then, like, 2 seconds after that kind of visual that you get, Dan go, oh, I'm so sorry. We're at the wrong grave. This is Mark White's grave. I'm so sorry. And then the movie ends.
It literally just ends. I was watching this on, like, an app, and it ended, and I went, wait a minute. And then immediately another movie started, and I was like, what the fuck is going on?
Yeah, it just ends with Paul dead.
Yeah.
There's a post-credit scene where we get, like, a flashlight on where Paul wrote the name Mark White on the inside of his coffin, but the light isn't, like, outside light. You don't get this idea that they opened the coffin. It's just, like, a quick pan on it, and I didn't get it, whatever they were trying to go for.
No, I didn't either.
But it was there. So, what'd you think?
It's not, like, a bad movie. I'm just not down with, like,
the propaganda aspect?
Yeah, I'm just a leftist.
Yeah, any other reason that we were in the situation, I think this would have, I would have been able to connect with this film a little bit more. I like, it did make me feel, like, closed in, right? Like, it did hit those feelings, but it also was really difficult to fully suspend disbelief and step into the movie while I was mad.
Like, yeah.
Just that, like, underpinning of stop with the propaganda shit, you know?
And there's, like, times where it's like, yeah, these corporations fucking suck. And even, like, the people that are supposed to be helping you are not, like, super concerned with helping you or whatever. Yeah.
They're more concerned with optics.
I feel like this is, like, saying something. And then it was like, okay, well, at the end of the day, the Arabic men are still the monsters, and I'm right. Like, oh, like, come on, like,
could we? Yeah, could have picked literally any other fucking reason, but
yeah.
So
woo. It's not terrible. That's the Brian Reynolds did a better job than I thought he was at the beginning of the movie. I was like, stop it, I can't take this man seriously.
But yeah,
he can act if he wants.
He can act if he wants. And it like, I'm with you. In the beginning, it took me a minute to realize, like, I know that he's done serious and heartfelt stuff, right? Like, I think that in a lot of the delivery of his more comedic characters, he is able to deliver, like, some heart stuff. But I did not. Just full, like, just Ryan Reynolds' face. It's like, are we telling jokes? What are we doing? Where's the humor? Oh, this isn't funny. Like, this is fully not funny.
No.
Yeah. Took me a second. All right. Well, yeah. Like I said, I'm not going to pay for it. I might turn it off, but I'm not mad about it. I just, you know, it was what it was. It is what it is. Okay. Well, you want to talk about today's topic now?
Yes.
All right. So, taphophobia, or taphophobia. Is an irrational fear of being buried alive. And again, I would like to say, when the fear makes sense, is it irrational because we think we're just going to walk down the street and one day be buried alive? Maybe that's what it is. Maybe that's what they're talking about.
I think,
but like, I feel like the fear of being buried alive is a solid fear. Like, that's a no, thank you.
Yeah, maybe it's like, you know, when you're a kid and you think like, there are going to be a lot more hazards. Maybe if you think like anytime you leave your house, you might be buried alive.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or whatever. But I don't think anybody would wake up in a coffin and be like, this is fine.
Well, yeah.
You know what I mean?
It's like last week we talked about how I was pretty sure the Benz was going to have more of an impact on my life. Like there are some things that you're like, yeah, I don't want to deal with that. But yeah. I when we call it irrational and I'm like, okay, maybe it's the situation that makes it irrational and therefore a phobia. That's probably it.
Yeah.
I think the fear itself is probably fine.
Yeah.
But it is connected to other phobias like the fear of death, fear of tombstones, and fear of cemeteries. And of course, the fear of tight enclosed spaces, claustrophobia. The root of the word itself is from Greek. Obviously, that's where most of our phobia situations happening, meaning with tapha or taphos, meaning tomb or graves, and phobos, meaning fear, deep fear of something.
Yeah.
And again, this fear isn't really one that's typically baseless. There are a disturbing number of stories and lots with actual documentation, which speak to people's friends and family members actually being buried alive. And there are more contemporary stories than you would think, although I'm going to stay away from those today because holy bananas, like that's really, really fucking upsetting.
I don't know if you're going to talk about it, but was it like cataplexy where people like look like they're just like frozen?
Yeah, that's I don't get into it too much today, but that is one thing that can happen with folks. That it's just like it's something that can happen and then the you're worst. Not dead. Like,
yeah.
And there are people in history like Harry Houdini who aimed to conquer this fear fully by allowing themselves to be buried alive, like choosing to do this, which is a choice. And the fear of being buried alive gave rise to one of the eeriest categories of inventions, coffin alarms.
Yeah.
So during the 19th century, a series of inventions emerged aimed at assisting individuals who may find themselves buried alive. These devices were designed to help the trapped person escape, breathe, or signal for help in a dire circumstance. One of these devices, and I'm going to send you the picture of the device itself right now. This is a patent for this device. Is like a pop-up ladder in the casket with the hopefully is departed but might not be departed. And so like through a series, if you look at this picture, it's like through a series of weird Rube Goldberg like actions, a pulley kind of lifts a small portion of the casket up while we're like revealing a ladder.
That's crazy.
Should have been dead person can climb up, or at least it like notifies folks nearby that like there's
somebody there.
Yes. Like it's, I think that they're maybe not accounting for the fact that you're buried under a lot of
dirt,
heavy dirt. But it got patented, and all you had to do in that little picture, and I'll post this to socials too, is like, all that guy had to do is apparently just pull this rope, and this whole series of zany actions happen to like pop the top on your coffin.
Yeah, because you're not like buried under like, I don't know, like moss, like what is it called? The moss or something. Yeah. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's probably like heavy brown soil.
Yeah. Yeah, it's
not to mention, I feel like these old machines, like 3 grains of dirt get in it and it binds up.
Yeah, that's one of the options.
Something to sell to somebody.
Yes. Yeah. And it was patented. I mean, I don't know if anybody ever actually was like, you know what, I'm going to go with a pop-up ladder. I think that's going to be the one for me. But there are others. Some are just bells attached to like a pole, which led down into the casket. And it was like a periscope is kind of what it looked like. So it like had a tube with 2 little poles on either side that the was supposed to be deceased could hold onto, like a periscope thing, and they could turn it to make the bell make sound. But the pipe was specifically wide enough, when the 2 like handhold pipes were wide enough on the inside that it was like piping in air.
Oh.
So they could just like turn this to ring the bell, but also they had air. But I like, are we? And we are, I mean, death was such a thing. I mean, we talked about it, like Victorian times and all that, like death, you plan for your funeral as much as you plan for your wedding, right? So like, maybe this was common knowledge for folks that like, if I wake up and I see the periscope thing, man, they sprung for the bell for me. And like, well, I'm so rich. Or like, ah, damn, I wake up and it's the pop-up ladder. These fuckers, where's my money? Like, I don't know how people knew to operate these machines, but apparently they did.
I'm sure it was like in the papers or something, you know what I mean? Like people knew about it or whatever.
You can come to the funeral home and test out your, like, where you're going to be resting, hopefully. Well, like,
I mean, when medicine was, I mean, medicine's still kind of wonky sometimes, but like, yes, when it was way more guessing, maybe it was just like a bigger thing that you had to think about. Like, oh, yeah, hey, you're kind of sick right now. We might think you're dead in a couple days. Do you know about the periscope thing? Yeah. Just in case.
A rope and bell? It's our cheapest option.
Yeah.
I'll give you some peace of mind. Or do you want to go for the whole periscope dealio? Pipes fresh air right in. but there are others. Like, there was one, like, obviously we've seen glass top caskets where we buried them, but we left maybe the top visible for a hot minute to make sure that they were really departed. Which, please don't put me in a semi-greenhouse. Like under the
just putrefaction.
And then you could see your way out, but it's glass thick enough that they will eventually bury the whole thing. Is that better? I don't think so.
Somebody gonna come check on me?
Yeah, like they just peep. You good? You good. Like, fuck.
You know, that was probably a job, like grave checker.
Like just
like, well, Larry's out here just like making sure everybody's actually dead.
You're like, hold on, honey, I gotta go check that grave. All right. Oh nope, this one's alive. I'll be late to dinner. Like, fuck, dude. There was one too that this one was super high tech. This one was, if the machinery detected movement in the casket, it like triggered a fan to turn on to blow air into the casket so the person could breathe.
What?
I have high tech. High tech.
I feel like something could have gone horribly wrong. The more high tech it is.
Yeah.
The more things can go wrong.
Like, you're also like, the dirt would settle, and I imagine like your body settles and stuff. But like, you just walk, you're just on patrol in the middle of the night, and you hear one of those fans kick on. Like, the fuck?
No. Absolutely. That'd be so scary. And it's like a rat or something got in the coffin, like, and you're like, oh no.
Because like critters have a purpose, right? Yes. And like, maybe like nowadays in our burial practices, it might be a little bit different. You know, it might be difficult for folks to think about, so we won't get into that too much. But critters have a purpose in their natural life cycle. And so like, back in 1885, a rat gets in and there's, all right, let's take care of the earth. And a fan goes like this. Maybe that's a great dining experience for that rat.
It's like a fancy restaurant.
Yeah, maybe it's just a good thing to say, but he's just like, all right.
We're talking about hypothetical corpses in the 1800s.
Hypothetical corpses. Yes.
They're not real. They're not real.
Yes. But as I said, And the less hypothetical, as I said, Harry Houdini was one of the people who was obsessed, of course, with conquering this fear and proving, I don't know, that he wasn't afraid of being trapped in a box. I don't get it. But he never really succeeded in actually being buried alive and freeing himself for all of his bravado. His first design of being buried alive as a performance never really saw the stage, with lots of posters being made, and then it just never happened to all accounts. Like, they just quietly just didn't do it.
And he was like, no.
Mm. And then his second was canceled due to him sustaining a pretty serious injury just before he was supposed to be buried alive. In his third iteration, he was testing the situation, was successfully buried, but ended up needing help to finish the escape, almost dying in the process, digging himself out to the point where only his fingers got above the ground, and then his team had to dig him out before he just fucking died. He wrote in his notes of the thing, because he would take lots of detailed notes about the stuff that he was attempting to perform and just keeping, you know, things documented. Mm-hmm. And in his notes, he said, "I tried out buried alive in Hollywood and nearly did it. Very dangerous. The weight of the earth is killing." And this is pretty telling, because in his last version, which is stirred by him wanting to, like, show up a mystic that he just wanted to piss off to say that they were, like, full of shit, Houdini would spend 90 minutes in a casket, but this casket was, instead of being buried, sunk to the bottom of a pool. Okay. He would never attempt the buried part of it again. He wouldn't add dirt to the top of any coffin. So, learned his lesson, I guess. But he never successfully. That
ladder's not going to work.
Yeah, a little ladder ain't going to happen. Little ladder. It's going to just, like, pop the casket enough to just let the dirt in. Like, just. Burp.
You imagine, you're like, oh, thank God. And just.
I got the ladder. Like, fuck, man. Ugh. Another person that attempted this to kind of, for a different reason, we weren't trying to show anybody up, but it was Mythbusters attempted this as well. Were you a Mythbusters watcher?
I was.
I was like, who hasn't seen Mythbusters?
Of a certain age, yeah.
Maybe that's a millennial thing. I don't know. But they decided to examine how long you could survive being buried alive and if you could possibly escape. Jamie, one of the show's hosts, bravely endangered himself to test this myth. He endured 50 minutes inside an unburied coffin, which, man, you got to zen out for that.
Yeah.
But then he managed just 30 minutes in the coffin once the soil was put on top of it. And I remember watching this episode, and they were so fucking careful. Like, there was, like, an emergency let out. The way that they built this was to make sure that he wasn't actually going to fucking die, because they very seriously thought that he might actually fucking die.
Oh, Jesus.
Super intense episode. I would definitely recommend watching it if y'all haven't seen it. But he was in the coffin for about 50 minutes, and they were like, okay, we're going to start putting the dirt on. And as they put the dirt on, you can see his anxiety level up, level up, level up. And there, the team's anxiety level up, because they can see, like, you can kind of see the side of the casket and the contraption that they built as they put the dirt on top so that he can escape easy. But either way, he only managed 30 minutes when the soil was loaded on top of the casket. And this is because the threat of suffocation due to lack of fresh air in the coffin was building. And then obviously there's a deadly buildup of carbon dioxide as you breathe out.
Mm-hmm.
So additionally, the coffin and its occupant faced the potential danger of being crushed to death by the weight above. The team feared sudden collapse, and that's what eventually, you know, had them stop the test and pull the emergency cord. After just 30 minutes of being covered in 6 feet of dirt, it was discovered that the coffin itself had buckled.
Oh, Jesus.
But they had buried him in the strongest coffin available. So it was like steel.
What?
And the weight of it, and, like, the top had just buckled a bit because of the weight.
Wow.
So.
Dirt's heavier than I thought it was.
I thought it
was heavy, but not like that.
It was just, like, he was going to get crushed. And they were like, fuck this, and pulled the cord. But again, thankfully, these attempts were monitored and all participants survived. Many of the real-life folks who find themselves buried alive are, though, simply not that lucky. Which leads us to one of the most confusing and terrifying stories that I was able to find regarding somebody being buried alive. And this is a 17th century woman named Alice Blunden. So Alice Davies, the daughter of John Davies, married William Blunden of Basingstoke. You can at me. Basingstoke in the UK. And this marriage took place on November 3rd of 1656. Alice and her husband were pretty well-known locals in their time, and by all accounts, the following story is, sadly, very true. William was a maltster, aka a person who makes malt for brewing or distilling, and seemingly there was a level of travel to his work as well, so he was very well-known, very good at it, apparently. Alice and he had two children, William and Elizabeth, and in most ways, they were a pretty typical family of the time. Alice did have a reputation for enjoying brandy a little too often, and this drinking sometimes extended to something called poppy water.
Oh.
Poppy water is made from unwashed poppy seeds and other items, and typically contained a decent helping of both morphine and codeine.
People were really just getting fucking lit back in the day.
Yes, indeed. In fucking deed. So in July of 1674, Alice drank a little too much poppy water and fell into such a deep sleep that she could not be woken. The doctor, using the most accredited medical tool at the time to detect death, a small mirror held to the mouth and nose, declared sleeping Alice to be dead.
Oh, geez.
Her husband, at the exact same time this was happening, had been told there was an exceptionally urgent matter needing his attending to in London. He told the doctor and the family that they were to wait to bury Alice until he got back from his business. And if they had just fucking listened, we probably wouldn't be telling the story.
I'd be so mad. You imagine coming home being like, are you fucking serious?
Yes. So the family thought they knew better. Alice was reportedly a larger person. The word used back then is gross, but the meaning of just of gross wasn't like, ew, gross. It was just a larger person.
Mm-hmm.
And back in the 16th century, like, there wasn't going to be a super easy way to cool a body for an extended period of time. If that body was larger, they were like, I don't know how we're going to fucking do this. And the family was like, given her size and the fact that it's mid-July, we're not waiting for you to come back from London.
Okay.
So they decided that they were just going to bury her, going against William's wishes. The following evening, her body was interred in Holy Ghost Cemetery, not far away from the Queen's School, which will be important later. So Alice, having what should have been a very long nap, found herself in a very dangerous situation. 2 days after she had been buried, two boys were playing along the graveyard after class when they heard something disturbing coming from one of the graves.
Oh.
They ran to their schoolmaster and reported hearing a voice coming from the fresh grave of Alice. Initially thinking the boys were just pulling a prank, the schoolmaster was fully like, nah, lies. You're just kidding. Like, I don't believe you. I'm not going.
You guys had patents for people to get out of coffins and you didn't go check it out?
Yes.
Jesus Christ.
He's like, you guys are fucking kidding. Go back to class. But the persistence of the boys and the story being told by a few different people, so more than just these boys, had heard a voice coming from this grave, got the curiosity of the townspeople piqued. And just before the end of the second day, a number of adults went to go to the grave to see what was up. And to their surprise, they also heard a voice coming from their grave. Horrifically, though, a number of the stories indicated the folks heard cries, but did not feel like they had the authority to dig up a corpse. And so they left her there overnight.
Oh, my God.
And in the morning, got the approval and dug her up.
Go wake up whoever's in charge of that and be like, we think there's a person down here.
Certainly can't interrupt supper to be like, there's a person buried fucking alive, man, over here.
Propriety is crazy. Like the weird little rules.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, man. Red tape means she's got to stay down there for a whole fucking night. Are you kidding me?
That's wild.
So the next day, they dug her up and they opened the casket and found an exceptionally terrifying sight. Alice's body was found to be, it's in quotes because this was what like the official story read, most lamentably beaten, which was thought to be the result of injuries inflicted on herself in her confinement, either trying to escape or just not having a good time.
Mm-hmm.
Her casket, too, was considerably less roomy than it might have been for somebody of a more average size, because obviously they made the coffin for average. And so on top of her being buried alive, she was even more restricted than she would have been. because they did not. I got the feeling the family was just like, let's do this quick. And her husband wanted to be like, let's do this right. And they did not wait for him.
Oh, my God. Hold on. Sorry.
I saw a cat run across the.
Oh, my God.
He is.
He like.
He wanted to hear this story.
He was trying to sneak by and then hit something and another like tab opened. And I was like, what the fuck is going on?
Okay. Oh, my God. So, yes, back to Alice. She's in a considerably less roomy casket than she would have been in. So not only did she wake up buried alive, but she was also basically in a wooden straitjacket on top of that.
Oh.
Unfortunately, by the time they dug her up and opened her casket, she was no longer exhibiting any signs of life, according to the townspeople anyways. I'm sure another mirror was involved. And they were just like, see, the mirror says. So they put her back in her casket and lowered her back into the hole of the grave and planned to call a actual coroner in the morning for like the following fucking day to make sure, you know, that like they do a more in-depth analysis of the body to see what exactly had happened. A guard was posted at her grave and they loosely covered the grave with soil. Because obviously the event had been pretty public, and so they didn't want somebody to come by and disturb the body. So they posted a guard. Unfortunately, and again, the townspeople let Alice down. The guard, who I'm sure just thought they were watching a dead body and not somebody who has now been twice buried alive, decided that they wanted to go get a drink at the local pub instead of staying at his post.
For fuck's sake. Couldn't they just have like left her on the grass? Or something, you know what I mean? Like,
no, I mean, I think there was negligence, abso-fucking-lutely. Maybe we shouldn't have put her back in the fucking ground. Maybe we should have taken her to the doctor's office and been like, let's have this ready for the coroner.
Or, like, put it back in the ground, but, like, leave the top off and, like, leave it unburied just in case. Because we weren't 100% sure.
Right. No, they lowered it in the ground and put a guard next to it. So in the morning, the town and the coroner returned to find no guard on duty, although there were growing rumors again that her voice had been overheard throughout the night by curious passerbys who did not intervene.
Dog.
So they once again brought the casket out of the ground and opened it to examine Alice. And once again, it was clear that Alice had actually woken up in the night and had not been dead when they again lowered her into the ground for the second fucking time, burying her fucking alive. This time, when she'd woken up, she had torn her clothes in an attempt to get out of the grave and to free herself. And a little bit gory here, had gotten so, I'm assuming, either panicked, overwhelmed, trying to escape, that she inflicted damage to her face, which was like quoted as ripping her own face off or removing her own mouth was a couple of the descriptions.
Oh my God.
It seemed like when she woke up again with the last bit of strength that she had, she fully panicked and terribly, terribly injured herself, being unable to get out of her coffin straitjacket.
Jesus Christ.
The coroner, who had been called, was understandably completely fucking mortified at the situation. The coroner declared that her life had been thrown away in his official report, and cited several of the local townspeople to the authorities for their inaction and negligence. So thrown away is like the 16th century, from what I could determine, like negligent death homicide of today. So like this coroner was like, you guys absolutely fucking did this. She was fucking alive. What is wrong with you? Like, what the fuck?
You were all aggressively stupid.
Like, holy, like twice buried alive. What the absolute fuck?
That's wild.
So yeah, the coroner was like, what the absolute fuck just happened here? Y'all need to be seen by the authorities. Ultimately, though, no individuals were convicted, but the town had a considerable fine set upon them for their neglect.
Oh, okay.
But I was not able to determine what that fine was.
Like two cows. So this
poor woman. What's that?
Like two cows.
I don't know, man. Like
5 pence.
You guys don't get to use the periscope safety thing from now on. Like, what the that coroner, I can't imagine. Like, he arrives on scene and he's like, guys, did we just say fuck it? Like, what?
The coroner actually is like a person of science and they're like, you fucking bumpkin ass motherfuckers. Like what are you doing?
And that guard who was like, meh, I just I don't want to stand there all night.
Beat him up.
what the fuck
did you do, Bill? God damn. Just
terrible. Absolutely terrible. So she's buried alive, not once, but fucking twice. And the town was like, I don't know if we can dig her up. It's probably illegal. We should just, I mean, she's in there. We're just going to leave her. What a shame. So there is a plaque up at the cemetery, which is still there, which reads, Miss Blunden, wife of William Blunden, maltster, was buried alive in the cemetery in 1674. Parliament fines town for its negligence.
That's the plaque.
That's the plaque. It doesn't have Alice. It doesn't have her maiden name. It doesn't have her actual name. It has wife of William Blunden. It has his profession. And that they fined the town.
Do you think that he came back and just beat everybody's ass?
I couldn't find anything after on the like after effects of it. I'm sure if I did a little bit more digging, it would be possible. I did find, you know, that they had two kids, and yeah. I'm sure they had to figure all that out. But like, can you come back and like your significant other's relations were like, meh, we went against your wishes. It turned out poorly though. So also, you know, you were right. Like,
fuck. How long does it take to come out of like a poppy water like coma? Because, like, I feel like in my mind, he, like, was like, don't bury her and left. And then she was buried within, like, the hour.
Yes. She was buried basically within, like, that same day. He was like, I've got to go. And they were like, quickie it. Let's go.
Even, like, now, at like, modern times, it takes a couple days to get, like, a funeral together.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know much about, like, the speed of that, but I would imagine there's some fucking planning involved. So.
Or, like, yeah, they were just like, nah, fuck it. Let's just do, we're doing it right now. They didn't even like give him like a day. They're like, okay, we gotta take care of this.
The doctor was like, all we have is this child-sized coffin, and they're like, yeah, it'll work. Like, I just fuck.
Somebody's cousin just did not like her.
Yes. Yeah, that, like, was a general vibe. I'm like, how, maybe it was just being pragmatic. They're like, yeah, it's fucking the middle of July in the northern hemisphere. This is gonna be a bad situation quickly. But I also wonder, too, if William suspected that he's like, yeah, this fucking doctor held a mirror to her mouth, but she's passed out for a couple of days before. Like, leave her alone for a few days. When I come back, we'll bury her.
Right. Like, nobody was like, Alice, that's her name.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody was like, Alice likes to get, like, fucked up.
Yeah.
Every once in a while.
Yeah.
Maybe just give it, like, I don't know, like 8 hours. If she starts to smell, bury her.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Or, like, put your little mirror against her mouth in, like, a day. What are we doing? Nope, like, they were just like, shit. Wrap it up, let's go. Twice buried. Twice
the fact that they unburied her and then were like, and then reburied her, but still wanted to have somebody check to make sure she was in like dead, is crazy. Like, what?
When I first read that story, I was like, I misread that. They reburied her, but called a coroner. Just, I think they called the coroner to be like, obviously the first doctor fucked up. Let's find out what happened. But they were suspicious enough that they did put a guard on post, and maybe that was just to make sure people didn't go fuck with the body.
Mm.
But they picked the most, like, untrustworthy guard of their town.
The, like, town drunk. Like, you know, I mean, he's not going to stay there.
Everybody enjoying a beverage. Man, take me a walk me down. Like, I don't.
Just.
I don't know.
That's some just, wild. That's some just wild crazy.
Wow. So how long. How long do you think a modern buried alive person could survive being entombed before they die? Any guesses?
I don't know. Like an hour? What the?
Yeah, I mean, so a typical healthy individual, if this is of comfort to anybody, might have anywhere from 10 minutes to an hour, according to some estimates. Some other estimates say 6 to 36 hours before succumbing to premature burial is what it's called.
That's assuming you weren't embalmed.
Yeah. I mean, that you are fully alive still. Yeah. Right. Like, yeah. So if you've just taken a poppy nap nowadays, anywhere between 10 minutes to possibly 36 hours, different sources, different sayings. All we know is it's definitely not like forever or for days. There's definitely some disagreement among scientists, but one certainty remains with this. Time is fucking limited if you are buried alive. The key factor is the amount of air contained in your coffin. Smaller individuals tend to survive longer because they occupy less space, therefore leaving more oxygen available. Once oxygen depletes, survival becomes impossible. Of course, we need it to survive. Those with exceptional lung capacity, such as swimmers or marathon runners, fancy fit people, might be able to eke out a couple extra minutes by taking deep breaths and holding their breath. But this is only recommended if you can then very calmly exhale and very calmly inhale, because your oxygen is limited. So
yeah. I don't think anybody's ever woke up buried in a coffin calmly and stayed calm.
This is fine. I'm fine.
Yeah, it's okay.
Absolutely all right. So even if you do manage to escape the coffin itself without depleting your air supply, you'd then face a predicament akin to being buried in a massive landslide. So the soil would be so dense above you and so weighty that it would basically prevent your chest from being able to rise and expand fully, even if you could somehow get vertical to dig through the soil. But luckily, nowadays we have better ways to test for somebody being alive. We don't just rely on the mirror test anymore. There's like a whole stethoscope situation. There's signs of life that they do. So it is less likely that you will be buried alive, but there are a disturbing number of contemporary stories which make this not impossible.
That's crazy.
So maybe we should all go pick out our periscope.
Yeah, dude, just shock me, like tase me. do something, dude. Like, I don't know. Anything to make sure I'm actually dead, please. God damn.
Days me took me
something
out.
Something.
Oh my god. But yeah, that's buried alive. That's the terrifying story of Alice, the twice buried alive person. And a little, you know, tidbit. You're probably not making it out of being buried alive, but you know, I hope you do.
That whole village has been dead for like 400 years and I'm just gonna be mad at them forever. That's so wild.
Oh god. Yeah. So what should we watch for our next episode?
We're gonna watch The Block Island Sound. I don't think a lot of people have heard of that, so you can watch it on Netflix or Amazon Prime.
The Block Island Sound?
Yes, The Block Island Sound. It's from 2020.
Awesome. All right, so watch The Block Island Sound. We will be back in your ears, remember, not next Tuesday, but the following. We're going to get into that rotation for you, so you can definitely expect us then. If you would like to chat about this or any other episode, head over to Instagram. It's where we're most active. We are also on Facebook and TikTok. You can find us at Nothing Scarier Podcast. You can also send us an email at nothingscarierpodcast@gmail.com. As always, thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.